It's time again for our chat with The Ethicist. Randy Cowan writes The Ethicist column for the New York Times Magazine, and every other week he stops by our New York studios to drop us just a few of his pearls of wisdom. Hello, Randy.
Oh, God, pearls.
I'd like some diamonds of wisdom, Randy.
God, well, as long as there's no pressure on me.
Just on the carbon. A lot of the people who write in about this segment want to know exactly what qualifies you to call yourself an ethicist. So I think it's high time that we take a moment here and look at the tools of the ethical trade. You agree?
Sure. There are many approaches to ethics. There are various schools of ethics, and they each have their limitations, but they each can be very, very helpful. I myself adhere to no particular school, but I'm guided by the philosopher John Dewey, who reminds us that each of these precepts are to be used not as rules, but as tools to help us understand the situation.
And you have a good pair of shin guards, right?
You always want to wear proper protective gear.
Last time we talked about transparency. Today you're going to talk about another sort of precept of ethical evaluations, I gather.
Yeah, there's an entire school of ethics, an approach to ethics called utilitarianism. The basic idea is to seek the greatest good for the greatest number, which is a wonderful idea when you want to, say, decide if we should use city land to build a public hospital or a solid gold steam room for Martha Stewart. You know, it's a great way to approach that kind of problem.
You know, that sounds like a good goal, Randy, but, you know, I suppose any modality of thinking has its demerits as well.
This one has one in particular, that it has an unsettling way of allowing a majority to bully a minority, particularly if the majority needs the minority's land to build a new shopping mall.
So if you're going to quantify ethical behavior, you need to make sure that it applies to the individual, not the individual who is thinking about necessarily majority good, but thinking about what's good.
I'd like to point out one more limitation to this idea, too, that greatest good arguments can lead us into conflicts with other values that we hold dear. For example, we might find that if we hang an innocent guy in the town square every day, that would really deter crime and so do enormous good for the entire community. But, you know, the hanged guy is going to object. People can be very selfish.
It's so true. So thoughtless of them. Well, we have a guest with us today. His name is John Caswell, and he teaches in the Wellness Department at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. He writes, "Each semester, teachers are evaluated by students, and we're given the results the following semester. I find the whole endeavor pointless because how can a student realistically evaluate whether a teacher has been effective? Students' opinions are almost entirely colored by how they personally feel about the teacher, but creating an atmosphere where students feel good about you is often counterproductive. Students grow by being challenged, and often we don't feel all that good about people who challenge us. My question, am I required to read my students' evaluations of me?" Randy?
Well, Mr. Caswell has certainly worked out a cunning strategy where he can dismiss all his critics even before they comment. And I think his premise is pretty dubious, Jackie, that he might be rated low because he's just too challenging. He's just too good a teacher. You know, it's undoubtedly true that some kids will fill these forms out unwisely and some will use them for revenge and some will fold them up into paper airplanes and put someone's eye out with them. But some may actually say something useful. If his department devised this method as one approach to evaluate teachers, then I think he must adhere to it.
John Caswell is joining us now by telephone. Hello, John.
Hello.
So what do you think of the ethicist's rather utilitarian advice here? Have you been reading your evaluations anyway?
Yeah, I have been looking at the evaluations anyway, and I guess because they almost always hurt my feelings, I was looking for a way to get out of that.
I feel your pain, John. You should read my mail. You know, my typical letter starts out, "Dear sir, I am appalled," and then goes on to enumerate not just the faults of my argument, but the flaws in my character. It's a brutal business reading these kind of essentially anonymous evaluations.
They
People
are
can be mean.
They do seem anonymous, and I was just hoping you would tell me, well, they don't know anything, and they wouldn't know whether you had taught them well or taught them poorly.
But I'll bet, have you ever found some that were useful or that helped you as a teacher?
The process is done in a way that I think sort of diminishes its effectiveness, and it's done on the very end of the semester, and you do it on the last day, and the kids sort of rush through it without much thinking. And I mean, you can watch them do it. It's on a Scantron sheet, and they just kind of rush through, you know, just mark and mark and mark, and then they're gone. you know, you could look at it from an epidemiological standpoint that, you know, if everybody says a certain thing, then that's something that you need to look at. But there's rarely a comment, you know, that you can grow from.
Maybe the solution then has to be that to either reform the system, and it's a conversation that should be held within the department. But I do think as long as you compel these kids to fill out these forms, you are obligated to at least scan them.
Sorry about that, John Caswell. Maybe you could at least make a date with yourself for a good glass of scotch after the evaluations are read.
Go get a massage after I've been pummeled by my students.
John Caswell in Dallas, Texas.